next case, which is case number 58313, Charlie Brown Construction versus Hanson Aggregates, Las Vegas. Council here, and we also have the consolidated case number 58966 as well. Okay, and we have Mr. Simmons for the appellant.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Charles Simmons. I represent the appellant, Charlie Brown Construction. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. Let me start by addressing the second question that the Court posed in this order, which is whether expert testimony regarding the cause of the defects have proven that Charlie Brown Construction was not a primary tortfeasor vis-a-vis Hanson. I'd love to be able to answer that question. Unfortunately, there was no expert testimony in this case. The Court would not permit any expert testimony in this case.
What offer of proof was made by your client to the judge before she granted the directed verdict about the expert testimony?
The offer of proof was that I had four experts that would testify in this case, three of which were the plaintiff's experts in the underlying case. I had a geotechnical engineer who was also a civil engineer, Mr. Marsh. I had a civil engineer, Mr. Schaefer, and a general contractor, Mr. Ortiz. In addition to that, I had my own expert who was also a geotechnical and civil engineer, Mr. Chris Verges. And the offer of proof was that none of the plaintiff's experts in the underlying case were critical of my client, Charlie Brown, who was the grader that did the soil preparation work, which was underneath the pavement in this case, that their testimony would have shown that the plans called out for 2 inches of asphalt underneath the soils. And the evidence would have shown that an investigation was performed by all of these experts in the underlying case, which established that in 3 of 4 locations, the 2 inches was not met. As a matter of fact, in 1 of the 4 locations, the pavement was 1/2 inch, which is 1/2 of the requirement, as was spelled out for in the plans. The testimony would have shown that that resulted in pervasive cracking of the pavement all over this project, to the extent that the entire pavement needed to be removed and replaced. As part of the investigation, the soils were also investigated. Coins were taken of both the pavement and soils. The soil samples were sent to a testing facility, and none of the experts in this case were critical of the soils in this case. None of the experts that I would have presented would have testified that the soils were a causal factor in the failure of the pavement.
Okay. I have one procedural question that maybe both of you can address. The way I think we understand it is that the Judge Johnson commenced the trial. Mr. Brown testified on behalf of the appellant, and then she wanted this offer of proof or whatever about what the experts would say, and then I guess she wasn't satisfied, and then she granted a directed verdict. Procedurally, is that correct? Is that what happened?
She granted the directed verdict not necessarily because what I just told you the experts would say wouldn't have satisfied her. She granted the directed verdict based, as I understand it, and after reading her order, based on 2 factors. The first of which is that we could somehow not show that the underlying settlement, the $300,000 settlement, was actually paid. That was something that she focused on throughout most of the discussion, which took place over a period of 2 or 3 hours. And then the second basis, which I'm not, to this day I'm very befuddled about, had something to do with that she was not comfortable or that she could ascertain damages to a reasonable degree of certainty, that she would have to speculate as to the amount of damages.
Well, let me ask you this. Here's the legal issue we're kind of wrestling with here, and that's why we want you both to address it. The court theoretically could have granted summary judgment before the trial started, but when the court started the trial, is it proper to grant a directed verdict until the in this case, the plaintiff has an opportunity to finish her case and rest? Can the court jump in the middle of the plaintiff's presentation of evidence and procedurally grant a directed verdict, or just require resting first so that and the reason we say that is we have standards of review for summary judgment. It's a certain standard, directed verdicts, another standard. And this one's kind of unusual that the judge intervened here before your client rested their case. So what's your thoughts on that?
My thought is that we're dealing with Rule 52C, mm-hmm. and that rule indicates that if during the trial without a jury, a party has been fully heard, we have not been fully heard. We have been allowed to call one of our four witnesses. It really doesn't say the party has been heard on an issue. It says the party has to be fully heard. I guess the question is who determines whether a party has been fully heard under that rule? Our position is the party determines that after the party rests or presents its entire case in chief.
I suppose the appeal is based upon an error in application of Rule 52, which sets up our standard of review.
That's part of Rule 52 that we're appealing from was the timeliness of the granting of the directed verdict. Just as importantly, there's another provision as part of Rule 52, Your Honor, that I think is just as important, if not more important, because I think it almost renders the timeliness issue moot in this particular case.
Okay.
And that part of the rule has to do with the court may enter judgment as a matter of law against that party with respect to a claim or defense that cannot, under the controlling law, be maintained or defeated without a favorable ruling on that issue. That is, that the judge would have had to have made a finding of fact that would have defeated all of my claims. That simply is not the case as a matter of law here. I pled four or five different causes of action, none of which had an element that proof of payment was required. None. And then the second issue with regard to damages is very, very puzzling to me because this case really is no different than any other construction defect case that I have been involved in and some of you may have presided over. These are not clean cases. There's multiple parties involved in these cases. There's multiple defects. There's allocations for defects. There's allocations for plaintiff's Chapter 40 entitlements post-trial. There's allocations for a portion of general contractor's fees and costs post-trial. And that's what a fact finder does. A fact finder takes all the evidence and makes those determinations. There is no requirement that damages in these types of cases or any type of case be proved with a mathematical degree of certainty. Damages only have to be reasonably accurate. And unfortunately, in these construction defect cases, there is some degree of leeway that a judge has, a trier of fact has, whether it's a jury or a judge, when they make these determinations. But this case was no different than any other construction defect case that's sued every single day. Were this court to require that proof of payment is an element of contribution or applied indemnity or a breach of contract or declaratory relief, that would mean that no general contractor could assert those claims, which are the claims that are typically asserted against the subcontractors in these cases, until they have paid a judgment that was rendered against it in a proceeding. That's simply not the way the jurisprudence in this state has ever worked.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
With regard to damages, my position is we were not only fully heard, we were not heard at all with regard to the issue of damages. She let me present one witness, which was a lay witness. I did not get to present any of my four expert witnesses. Charlie Brown's position at the time of trial was that the entire $300,000 settlement was paid to resolve the defective pavement claims. The entirety of that. Although there were other defects allocated to Charlie Brown in the settlement demand, none of those were within Charlie Brown's scope of work. And the only witness I was allowed to present testified to that effect.
As to what we have in this particular case, I guess as a premise, we have whether or not the court applied the appropriate standard for indemnity claims. We're aware of the Aetna Cagley case in terms of payment, but which probably is not applicable here under the circumstances. But you talked a little bit about whether or not the law was appropriately applied as to indemnity and that the court misread it. And secondly, I guess I come back to the issue of proffer and the reading of the statute in terms of completing the presentation, but your first witness on the stand basically says he signed this, the attorneys told him to sign it, didn't understand, didn't know what how the settlement was reached. Quick summation of his testimony. So when the court said, counsel, what else do you have? And I guess I understand you had some additional experts. Will they testify that these experts, that the work that was done by this third party, the sub, on the paving, was what the settlement was about?
Yes. They were prepared to testify.
Was that proffer made to the court?
Yes. With regard to an indemnity claim, that's essentially an entire shifting of responsibility from one party to another based upon the degree of wrong of the conduct of the parties. And lots of these cases talk about active versus passive misconduct or conduct. In this particular case, all the experts I would have called as witnesses would have testified that Hanson Aggregates, the paver in this case, was 100% responsible for the defective asphalt, and that John Brown was not responsible.
Can you give the cites in the record as to that proffer?
I don't have the, I can't do that, you know, very quickly. I can certainly go through the record and perhaps some other body try and find that.
Why should you do that if you could, if you take a moment on opposing counsel argues and let us
It was also, I might say it was also in my opening statement.
Okay. Okay, and you've got about 4 minutes left. You want to reserve the robos. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Schiller for the respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Respectfully. Which question would you like me to answer first? Because I'd like to deal with the two questions that the court has raised. The first one...
Well, why don't you talk about maybe the Rule 50 versus 52, and should we define that particular term in Rule 52 and a reasonable opportunity to be heard, and should it require you to be able to rest your case first?
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. In terms of 52C, the only case that we were able to find that dealt with that was actually one that you had presided on, Your Honor, certified fire, and that particular case allows the district court in a bench trial to enter judgment on partial findings against a party when the party has been fully heard on an issue, not on all the evidence, on an issue. And judgment cannot be maintained without a favorable finding on that issue, not on all the evidence. It goes on to say, where a question of fact has been determined by the trial court, this court will not reverse unless the judgment is clearly erroneous and not based on substantial evidence, citing the Cocos case.
What's the citation in that case?
It's 90 Nevada, 130 at 133.
90 Nevada.
I'm sorry, I can give you the Pacific Second site.
In 90 Nevada, I wasn't.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. 520 Pacific Second at 1359 at 1361. And that's the Cocos case, and then the actual site that I was reading from came from the certified fire protection case, if you'd like to say.
If we accept completely heard on an issue, if we accept that, then it takes me back to whether or not the court applied the appropriate standard in indemnity itself. Because the court seemed to be looking at, was something paid and not as to fault at all. It just shifted to the payment.
Well, and I would respectfully disagree with that in the sense I was there, and the court was very, very thorough in investigating the issue with respect to...
The order doesn't say that.
Okay.
So that's why I raised this
point. Okay.
The order was clear and said, we find it doesn't say that. It talks only about the money not being paid. So... If you respond to that.
I would add a footnote to that. It would appear, at least my review of the record suggests, that no opportunity was provided to Charlie Brown in this instance to even say, you know, Judge, give me 10 minutes, I'll get somebody in here to show you what it is that you're looking for.
Yes.
I.e., that the check had been negotiated.
And that issue was raised during the trial itself, and the particular question was addressed by Judge Johnson. And how she handled it was, she said, well, even if I allow you to bring somebody in here, to address the issue of whether or not that was paid, you still have the threshold issue of what it was paid for. And in this case, they couldn't meet the first requirement, which is the question you were asking, Your Honor, and that they had no witnesses on their witness list at all that could testify to any of that with respect to the payment of the check, the cashing of the check, and really the big issue here, Your Honors, is what was it paid for?
But the experts could have testified as to what the damage was and who caused it and whose work it was.
Yes, they could, but I also can cite to testimony of Mr. Marsh, who is plaintiff's expert, where he said that the base material was in three out of the four cores was less than it should have been per the specs.
But by your own comments here today, it appears to me that had those witnesses been allowed to testify, the question that before us now could have been answered as to what that money was paid for.
No. And let me tell you why, Your Honor. First of all, we were never involved, Hansen was never involved in the underlying case. So we were brought in 2 weeks before trial. The judge determined that wasn't fair and said dismiss without prejudice. They then brought this, really characterizing it as contractual indemnity, implied indemnity, but really a subrogation case against my client. Mm-hmm. What they were exposed to during the original case were many things that my client was never exposed to. Number one, contractual indemnity issues. The demand letter from Horizon to Charlie Brown had a section with express indemnity requirements, and their demand was based in part on that.
But counsel, that's not what was before the court, at least the small portion we're dealing with. We're dealing with a court that cut this off after one witness. There's an alleged proffer, and I guess my direct question to you is, as I ask counsel, they attempted to make the proffer. If you can show me where that proffer was made, and if you would tell me why that proffer was insufficient, so that the court should have ended right there.
May I respond here? Okay. Well, that's the other part of the problem, and that's part of what Judge Johnson had great difficulty with, was she was having great difficulty with the fact that there were contractual indemnity issues, AI issues, Chapter 40 allegations, and that there were 17 defects alleged against Charlie Brown, only three of which could possibly have been alleged against my client. Now, they make the statement that only three of them involved Charlie Brown, but that's not what the plaintiff thought. So we don't know what the plaintiff thought, we don't know what Horizon thought, and we don't know why this case settled. All we know is we think $300,000 was paid.
But wouldn't Mr. Marshall testify to that?
No, Your Honor. He doesn't have any...
He was expert, though, right?
He was plaintiff's expert, yes. But he wouldn't be able to testify as to any of the issues involving anything but the defect itself. He couldn't testify as to any of the other issues for which we settle cases here in Nevada, the biggest one of which is the Chapter 40 claims. We all know that's a gorilla on everybody's back when we deal with these cases. Well, from personal experience handling, might be thousands of these cases, Chapter 40 is the driving force. And nobody wants to go to trial, be the last man standing, and respectfully, the judge finds that you owe all the plaintiff's attorney's fees and costs, as well as the general contractor's attorney's fees and costs, and maybe the developer's attorney's fees and costs, and the exposure of $200,000 now becomes $1 million or $2 million.
It's still no legislative action to change that chapter. That's an aside.
But may I address the 52C issue again? Mr. Simmons read the 52C section. What I'd like to point out is in drafter's notes below those, and in the 2004 amendment, it says, and I quote, it authorizes the court to enter judgment at any time. That it can appropriately make a dispositive finding of fact on the evidence. That's what Judge Johnson did. It goes on to say, And this is particularly instructive. The new subdivision replaces part of former Rule 41B, which had authorized a dismissal at the close of a plaintiff's case. If the plaintiff had failed to prove a sufficient case for the court, that particular section was replaced by 52C, and the drafter's note says that it can be done at any time.
When was it replaced? When was it done?
It says the 2004 amendment, Your Honor.
Okay.
And it's right below, it's in the statute itself, right below the statute.
So you, that may supersede any previous case law on that issue.
Dealing with this particular point, yes, Your Honor. I would say that probably does. I don't know how much time we have left, so.
You have 6 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor.
I was just going to say, is there any commentary between the federal rule and Nevada's adoption of that?
I'm glad you asked that, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to the only case, like I said before, that we could find was the certified fire protection case. The federal judiciary has dealt with this issue on a number of occasions, as well as certain treatises. In Wright and Miller, Federal Practice and Procedure, Civil 3rd, Volume 9C, Section 2573.1, it says, it is entirely discretionary whether the judge wishes to render judgment before the close of all evidence in the case. The judge can do this by denying the motion or reserving it until the end of the case. Going on, in the Stone versus Milstein case, 804 Fed Second, 1434-1437, however, it makes sense that the court must first analyze whether the plaintiff has presented a prima facie case. For failure to do so should end the adversary proceeding at that point. What Judge Johnson did was she evaluated the available evidence after an offer of proof by the appellant and came to the conclusion that none of the experts could testify as to how this settlement was reached. They could testify to what the defects were. But Mr. Simmons doesn't mention also is that we had an expert in that case, and he certainly was going to point the finger at Charlie Brown, and 75% of that base material was deficient. There's a very large question of fact as to whether or not Charlie Brown was responsible for these issues. Mr. Brown, in his own testimony, walked the site with the general contractor and found none of the asphalt issues that the plaintiffs was claiming and said the asphalt looked wonderful. Granted, he didn't do any cores, but he was there on site watching the asphalt being laid, and he had no criticisms of our client as to the work at the time it was being done and or when it was finished. If I can give you a few more federal sites if you'd like, Your Honor. With respect to the Ritchie case, Ritchie versus United States, 451 Fed 3rd, 1019 at 1023. In determining the motion, the judge is not to draw any special inferences in favor of the non-moving party. This is a different standard than a motion for summary judgment, because evidence is being heard and the judge is the fact finder. Therefore, it is her job, his job, to make a determination whether she's or he has heard the appropriate and full factual scenario. Judge Johnson came to that conclusion. And that particular site also went on to say, and if so, what standard should be used in ruling on a 52C? That also cites to Wright and Miller Federal Practice and Procedure. So, I think from the drafter's notes, from the federal case law, and partially from the certified fire protection case, which dealt with this issue, but the plaintiff did finish their case in that particular matter, the statute 52C is clear on its face, and it was even further clarified by the drafter's notes as to what the intent was. What it does, Your Honor, is it gives the judge the freedom to handle the case in the manner that it best serves judicial economy. In this particular instance, Judge Johnson made the determination that she had heard everything that she could hear after the offer of proof, and as Mr. Simmons says, the offer of proof, we had this colloquy going on for, I would say it was 3 or 4 hours, but we went over and over and over. Mm-hmm. And the judge went to great pains and great efforts to hear everything that she could hear that addressed the issue of payment, what the payment was for, and who was involved in those payments, and what part of that payment was for Chapter 40 AI contractual indemnity defect issues, none of which, except the defect issues, was my client exposed to. None. So I would submit to the court that Charlie Brown settled this case because they didn't want to be the last man standing. It's not fair. But I've been there. And I've been the last man standing. It's not a good feeling. And I tried it and it is a terrible feeling. And I empathize with Mr. Simmons in that regard. But that does not affect the fact that when you bring a claim for indemnity or subrogation, that you have to prove that claim. I do not believe that Charlie Brown did it in this instance, and obviously Judge Johnson didn't feel that they were able to do so, despite giving them considerable leeway in the offer of proof and the evidence. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Simmons.
The record, the appellate record is replete with instances where I made an offer of proof that all of the responsibility for the defective pavement lied with Hanson Aggregates. If the court turns to page 613 of the record on appeal, this was part of the colloquy that I had with the judge where she asks me, is there going to be somebody up here to tell me we did not pay for these defects, meaning that Charlie Brown is not responsible for the pavement. My answer was there would be someone up here to tell you that none of the defects were attributable to my client's work. I could probably find 20 or 30 other instances during this long colloquy where I made similar offers of proof, and that's all in the appellate record. Let me dispel very clearly the issue of whether or not payment was established, because this is probably the biggest red herring in this case. First of all, it's not an element of any of my claims. Prior to the trial starting, Hanson brought a motion to dismiss this entire case because Charlie Brown is not a real party in interest, because it didn't pay any money. The judge denied that motion. And ruled that Charlie Brown was a real party in interest, and signed an order that contained several findings of fact. And that order was filed on 11-19-2020. Two of the findings of fact that she made that were part of the order were that settlement was reached in the Apache Springs case and paid by insurance carriers for Charlie Brown Construction on behalf of Charlie Brown Construction. Another finding of fact the judge made in that same order was pursuing the settlement having been paid by the insurance carriers of Charlie Brown Construction. The insurance carriers had a potential subrogation claim against Hanson. So this issue that payment was not established was already established prior to the trial starting. Why the issue was even brought up during the trial was, it really caught me off guard, and to this day I don't understand why the issue was brought up. I thought it was resolved. The whole idea was that the insurance carriers wouldn't have a second bite at the apple, which was never my intention. With regard to Mr. Sherlock's contention that there was something wrong with the soils did test, they weren't the correct thickness in a couple of locations, but the type of soil that was used made up the difference for the thickness of the soil. The type of soil that was used and the compaction of that soil was sufficient. So this issue that somehow or another the thickness of the soil beneath the pavement was a contributing factor is just something my experts would not have testified to. And several arguments that Mr. Shellhart made as to what his expert would have testified to, namely placing some of the blame on Charlie Brown, merely underscores the court's need to allow those witnesses to testify. If a court were merely allowed to screen an attorney's case without letting the attorney fully be heard on the issues, I might suggest that anything the attorney says during that colloquy is not evidence and cannot serve as a basis for a finding of fact or conclusions of law, which is the very purpose of the rule. So you have to allow evidence as the judge if you're going to use your discretion under Rule 52C. You can't really entirely, or almost entirely, screen an entire case and ask the attorney what his or her case is going to show.
Let me ask you, under Rule 52C, we heard what Mr. Shellhart said that the 2004 amendment would seem to indicate that the judge could stop the case here before you rested if the judge determined there was sufficient evidence to do so. I know you argue that the judge abused your discretion in doing that, but do you agree with that, that at least that changed the old Rule 41 standard?
I do agree that it changed the old Rule 41 standard. I don't agree that the judge can cut off a case before the plaintiff has fully presented their case.
The terminology, I mean, when we try and square up the issues, so you're saying that rather than deal with the issue whether you rested, it's the term you're referring to, or we should refer to in analyzing this, is whether you had a full opportunity to present your case.
No, not necessarily, Your Honor. I would contend that there is no reason why Rule 52C should be treated any differently than Rule 50, which has to do with jury trials.
Right.
I understand that in a bench trial, the judge has a dual role. The judge is a fact finder. The judge is also an arbiter of the evidence and the enforcer of the rules of civil procedure. If the purpose in Rule 50 does contain a separate provision, that provides that you can't issue judgment as a matter of law only after the presentation of a plaintiff's case or the entire case. I submit to the court that the public policy reason behind that rule, which I assume is to promote judicial economy, is no different than in a non-jury trial. As a matter of fact, I would argue it's even more important in a jury trial, because in a jury trial, you're utilizing valuable jury resources, and the court should be allowed to cut a case off if the court doesn't feel that a client...
But in a jury trial, the judge isn't the fact finder, the jury is, so that's the distinction here.
Oh, no, I understand that, but the judge is a arbiter of the evidence and the enforcer of the civil rules, and the promoter of judicial economy serves the same role in both types of cases. The timing of this can be debated. I think the more important issue with regard to the rule is that the findings of fact made in this case did not defeat all my claims, and I simply was not allowed to be fully heard on virtually any of my issues.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank both of you. And for those of us who practice civil law for a lot of years, we really get excited about these issues. I know maybe the general public doesn't, but we're very interested in them when they come in, and that's why we want to have little arguments and go through them. Thank you. All the excellent arguments on both sides and briefs. We'll certainly look at the record on that both of you decided to in the rules, and the case will stand submitted, and we'll get our decision out. Thank you very much.